Please rise.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bentley, Judge Bratfold, Judge Frisch, the Honorable Elizabeth Graber Bentley presiding.
Thank you. You may be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals. For the audio record, today is September 17th, 2024, and today's argument is being live streamed, and we are also making an audio recording. The audio will be available on the court's website within 24 hours. And just a quick reminder that there's no other recording permitted without the express permission of the court. We have had three cases on our oral argument calendar. We heard one earlier this morning. And we will now begin with the second case, followed by a third case at 11:15. As a quick note, we'll take a short recess after this case concludes, when we will proceed with our third case. So with that, Marshall, can you please call the next case on the calendar?
Now calling case number A24-0604, Ariel Incorporated Appellant versus State Farm Fire and Casualty Company Respondent.
Great. Good morning, counsel. You'll each have 15 minutes for argument this morning, and appellant has an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal time. Before your argument, please identify yourself and the party you're representing. You may begin.
Good morning. Thank you, Your Honors. My name is Edward Beckman, representing Appellant Ariel, Inc. May it please the court, counsel. Summary judgment is not the time to choose the best set of facts and the most persuasive set of facts. It is to determine whether there is a genuine issue of material fact. In the underlying case, an almost two-year adjustment period, given the riots and a fire in this very large commercial building in Minneapolis, the insurer and insured were communicating about the value and scope of the loss using Xactimate software. That's a very common software in the industry, used to communicate the value and the amount of loss, replacement cost value, actual cash value. Early on, State Farm is using it to communicate what it believes is the value of the loss. Later in time, a public adjuster is brought on board for the insured, and that public adjuster is valuing the repairs that are being done using that same software and then distributing it on to State Farm, specifically adjuster Brian Knapp. Now, just before the expiration of the two-year statute of limitations, there's a conversation between Mr. Knapp and the public adjuster, and it's memorialized in a letter. I encourage the court to review that letter, which is submitted as part of the addendum. And it says, in part, we'd like to see the electrical subcontractor invoicing. We're not going to extend the period of time to bring suit. And I'd like to look at the ESX file, which is the electronic version of this very large documentation the public adjuster submitted. He submitted two documents. One, the overall scope of the claim, no matter if State Farm has agreed to it or not, and then a separate document that isolates the amount in dispute. And so
counsel, would you mind? I just want to make sure I'm following your argument, because I certainly have read through the factual record in this case, and all of the facts that you're referring to now are familiar to me. Here's what I'm not 100% clear on in your brief, but I think I follow. Do you agree that before State Farm pays you under this policy, that is your obligation as the insured or your client's obligation to show that you have actually spent money on the repairs for which you are now seeking reimbursement from State Farm?
In the sense of spending money and a debt incurred as opposed to an actual cash payment, that is our position.
Right. And that you're basing that on the terms of the policy, right?
I am.
Okay. So where is that evidence that was offered on summary judgment?
Okay.
The evidence that shows you that Ariel actually spent money on the repairs.
And that would be the declaration of the public adjuster, Don Conklin, the declaration of Jerome Mitchell, that explains the relationship between himself and Mr. Conklin. The invoice, then?
So let's take those one at a time. So starting with Conklin's estimate, and I understand he did more than one, and he refined them over time in part with these conversations with Mr. Knapp, or communications with Mr. Knapp. But Conklin, as noted by the district court, Conklin does describe them as estimates, They do not look like invoices. If Ariel actually spent the money, in my experience, there were invoices. So I'm confused. Why aren't there invoices in the record?
Sure. I believe either Jeannie Stoddard or Jay Mitchell on summary judgment produced the invoice.
Well, there is that one invoice for $1.5 million that has almost no detail. Is that?
That's because they attested that the detail behind the $1.5 million is Mr. Conklin's work. Mr. Mitchell testified at his deposition, which is also in the record, that he became really overwhelmed by this large process. So first he hires Jeannie Stoddard to help, and then later in time he refers in public adjuster Don Conklin because he has that Xactimate software. And he can then communicate easily and efficiently with State Farm about the work that has been done and the value of it. Because it's important to know that the general contractor here is not just a paper contractor that hires a bunch of subs. He's done some work himself.
I think the leap in the factual arc here is, how do you get from the invoice to, I paid this invoice because this is the work that was done to cover the loss? Where is that in the record, and how would that even be presented at trial?
Ariel did not pay a check for $1.5 million to Universal. The agreement was that the funds for the repairs would be from the insurance company, State Farm, an insurance proceeds agreement. And so the policy requires, and I think that Savannah Grove case from the district court is a very interesting case, and I'll get to that in a minute. I think what the policy requires is the money was spent, i.e., the work was done and the expense was incurred. And so when we're talking about, did my client comply with the terms of State Farm's policy, it is to demonstrate that the amount was actually indeed spent.
So maybe a question I have, and this goes to the district court's characterization, as I understand it, of the Cochran report as being an estimate. But is that inaccurate in your... Is your position that is not actually an estimate, but the Cochran report is a report of work actually done, and therefore that contributes to the debt incurred? So what is in the Cochran report? Was that... Go ahead.
Yep. That is our position, that is work actually performed. But everyone's going to refer to it as an estimate because lay people who are using Xactimate all the time and in this arena all the time are going to refer to it as such. Okay, because this is how insureds, public adjusters, and adjusters communicate with each other all the time. It's why Mr. Knapp wanted to see the electronic version so he could go in and take a look. But he testified in his deposition that he understood that the repairs had been done when he received these documents from Mr. Cochran. So it is an...
And in your view, is that the best evidence that the 1.5 were repairs that were actually incurred by your client?
That'll be our best evidence at trial on summary judgment. That's probably our best evidence, but also the declarations submitted by Mr. Mitchell and Ms. Stoddard, both of Universal Construction. And then there's deposition testimony as well, where Mr. Mitchell is explaining this as well. But I suppose the best evidence is, yeah, where Mr. Knapp understood when he got this that the work had been done.
So what was different then about what he received with respect to this, the remaining $1.5 million, compared to the $3.3-something million that had already been paid out? So it's as if they had received other information with respect to those claims that they didn't receive on these remaining ones? Or what's... Because they clearly paid out a bunch where they were sure that the work had been done. What was the difference here?
Well, State Farm never agreed to pay the $1.5 million. They agreed to, I believe it was $3.5 million. And so that Exhibit B to his declaration sets forth line items showing the differences, and there are many differences.
I guess, sorry, my question was more about what documentation did they receive with respect to the $3.3 million that they've not received, or at least the record, not showing in the record documentation as to the work completed for the remaining $1.5 million.
Okay, so the documentation to show that the work was done was both Mr. Conklin's estimate. There were also inspections of the property. There was an email from Mr. Conklin about 2 weeks before, I think this is Exhibit C to his declaration, saying the work is almost done. And I'm going to send you more invoicing and this large Xactimate document. Yeah, I believe that's Exhibit C to his declaration.
His being Conklin?
Yes.
Yes, that's what right. I thought you meant. Thank you.
So we think what a jury would do, or the trier of fact would do on this issue, is they would listen to the evidence come in. They would hear about Xactimate. They would hear about how these folks had communicated for the better part of 2 years on a very large file. And then at the end, there was apparently a dispute about the scope of loss, and that probably gives me a segue into our next argument, that I think the district court erred in not allowing an insurance appraisal to determine with finality the amount of the loss, because what Mr. Conklin is doing is saying, here's where we're at. It's an extra $1.5 million, and then it's in the hands of State Farm and Mr. Knapp to respond. Okay, so there's this argument that appraisal is not ripe because there wasn't a dispute yet. But it was in Mr. Knapp's hands to respond under the policy and adjust it, agree or disagree. So I don't think my client can be criticized for not demanding an appraisal, because when he's waiting for Mr. Knapp's position, and he also testified at his deposition that it is possible that after this two-year mark, he might pay on invoicing he might pay on expenses that he agreed with. So there, the claim, just like all contractual rights, nothing ends with litigation. The contract is real and it's ongoing. In fact, the contract itself says my client has to keep records for 3 years. What's odd about this case is that once suit commences, because it has to, or else my client loses any legal right to recover anything, State Farm essentially goes silent, and then the next response is really the answer to the complaint. And the answer to complaint says, we don't think anything further is owed. We've paid all that we're going to pay. So procedurally, the thing to do is, and this, there's a statutory right to this as well, is to appraise what the dispute is between the amount of loss, and that is binding on insurer and insured as to what the amount of loss is. And then there's usually a demonstration that the repairs were done, and of course here the repairs were done. And then a payment is issued consistent with the appraisal award, and that's some of the relief that we're asking for here today, is to allow that appraisal process to continue, because we did all that we could at the time, because we didn't know how State Farm would respond to Mr. Conklin's $1.5 million estimate in the amount of dispute.
So before we spend much more time on the appraisal issue, and I appreciate that summary, I want to make sure I cover how the district court analyzed the State Farm's right under the policy to request records and documents related to the loss. And as we're all well aware, you view that differently, and your client views it differently from State Farm. But State Farm's testimony and evidence is that they did demand invoices to show that the repairs had actually occurred and that they had been paid for. And you've already talked about how your reliance on the Conklin documents and on Mitchell and his affidavit. What I'm trying to understand is that a condition precedent to recovery under the policy? It seems to me that's the way the district court analyzed the issue. The district court looked at it as a condition precedent. And are you satisfied with that analysis? Because, as I said, you rely on Conklin and Mitchell. I just want to make sure I understand your position.
Well, our position is that the documentation State Farm sought could have been and was produced in discovery. Rule 26 disclosures, answers, and interrogatories, documentation.
Right. No, I understand that The timing. I'm interested in the legal question. So that, is that a condition precedent to recovery under the policy?
The condition precedent is a demonstration in some manner of the amount spent. But our position is it does not require a document that says invoice, a document that says anything. If that were so, Your Honors, the policy needs to say that. I mean, they're saying we didn't satisfy the contract. I think it is for the trier of fact to say whether or not that language was satisfied, and there is at least a genuine issue material fact if it was. And I refer back to that Exhibit C that Conklin.
But it sounds like, if I'm understanding you, and you can definitely explain more in your rebuttal if you'd like. I realize the time is running. It's how we analyze a recovery under the policy as a matter of law, not whether you produce the proof, but whether there is a condition precedent in the policy to recovery. And that would be that you respond to these requests for documentation from State Farm.
Yeah, that's under the cooperation clause. Mm-hmm. So there's the cooperation clause, and then there's the what we need to do to recover the RCV, the replacement cost value. And there is a requirement in the policy that requires us to demonstrate the amount spent. But our position is that can be done in a variety of ways. Orally, call up the contractor, site inspection by State Farm, delivery photographs, matching up. It can be done in a variety of ways. And our position is that there's nothing in the policy that absolutely requires. It's got to be this thing called an invoice. I see that I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you. Council floor respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Scott Williams. I represent Respondent State Farm Fire and Casualty Company. With me at the council table today is Attorney Lindsay Stryker of our office. Ultimately, Your Honors, I think this is an insurance situation that we all would hope would take place if you have a significant fire loss. Here, a claim was presented to State Farm of significant value with significant damages. State Farm adjusted the claim, paid more than $3 million. The property was put back into its pre-loss condition. And frankly, everyone's happy, or should be, because you've got a property owner that has restored building, that paid nothing out of pocket to have that restored building. I think the testimony from Ariel's representative was that the property looks great, and no one is claiming that Ariel owes anything to anyone. There's essentially-
No, but Ariel's position is that they have essentially become a debtor to Universal. In this case, I mean, you're shaking your head, but that's their position. Is it enough to raise a genuine issue of material fact, given, as you just said, the repairs were done, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So the repairs are done and complete, and according to them, the complete repairs are another $1.5 million, roughly, than what they received from State Farm.
And that's just not what the record shows. The repairs were completed for the $3.3 million that State Farm paid. And
so what do we do with the $1.5 million, you know, reading both the Conklin estimate, the 66-page document or 62 or whatever it is, and then the Mitchell affidavit that says that this invoice for $1.5 million is actually supported by the 66 pages compiled by Mr. Conklin, and it shows, and I'm reading from the affidavit, that the total amount actually and necessarily spent for repairs.
Well, so here's the situation. It's under the policy contract.
And I'm not saying, you know, they win. I'm saying, isn't that a genuine issue of material fact?
No, because
why not?
Because under the policy contract, as has been talked about here today, the insured must show that it actually spent the amount, and then there must be a demonstration that that amount was necessary to repair or replace the lost or damaged property. So there's really two concepts there. One, which is
But you haven't challenged at this point. You haven't spent the necessary. You haven't challenged the necessary part.
Well, right, and that's where I think
you got summary judgment on the actually spent part.
Right. I mean, I think the necessary part would go into, you know, some of the other stuff that we talk about appraisal. You know, if we actually had a dispute about whether the amount spent was necessary.
Sure. Yeah. But what I think you preserved that. Yes.
Thank you. Yes. And what's absolutely clear, though, under the record, is that nothing was spent beyond what State Farm paid. In other words, State Farm paid the $3.3 million. That amount restored the property to its pre-loss condition. Ariel had zero out-of-pocket expenses.
So how does the district court on summary judgment ignore this statement in Mr. Mitchell's affidavit? I didn't see it discussed in the district court's opinion. So I'm confused. How does that get ignored?
Well, are you talking about Universal Constructions?
I'm talking about Mr. Mitchell's affidavit that says, you know, it attaches Exhibit A, it has the invoice for $1.5 million, and then it says this $1.5 million is consistent with the amount owed per Don Conklin's final estimate. It shows the total amount, and I'm omitting a few words in between, but shows the total amount actually and necessarily spent for repairs to the property.
Sure. And so Jay Mitchell is a representative of Universal Construction, not an insured under the policy contract.
Yeah, but that doesn't matter. He could be a witness. He is a witness, right?
Right. But what matters is that there was no money that exchanged hands. He never got
paid. Why does that matter?
Because it demonstrates that he was able to actually do the work for $3.3 million. No subcontractor is claiming that Universal Construction owes anything to
anyone.
This
sounds like your closing argument at trial to me. That's what it sounds like.
But I would disagree because ultimately, again, what evidence is there that there was actually money spent beyond what State Farm paid?
Here's a question, and correct me if I'm wrong from the record, but I had thought that the practice for that $3.3 million that was already paid, that it was paid to Ariel before they paid Universal, and they would then basically forward it. So even in the $3.3 million you've already paid was similar as far as the transactional path as this alleged outstanding $1.5 million, right? They had gotten an invoice or whatever from Universal, submitted materials to State Farm. State Farm pays Ariel. Ariel pays it to Universal. So is that wrong?
Well, it's a little bit wrong in the sense that State Farm issues a payment based on its own estimate. So State Farm goes out and takes a look at the loss, considers the information that the insured submitted, and then makes payment based on its own estimate. And so when you get a payment, you get an estimate from State Farm that identifies what work State Farm believes needs to be completed, and then basically, you know, issues the check associated with that estimate. And so it's not necessarily the case that State Farm's getting a one-page invoice from Universal Construction saying $1.5 million, and then State Farm just goes, oh, okay, where do we issue the check? I mean, State Farm is doing its own analysis and evaluation of the claim. And State Farm's view at the outset was that, you know, $3.3 million is what it's going to take to repair this property. And that's exactly what happened. Now, ultimately, we've got someone here claiming, well, you know, we need $1.5 million more. But who is that? Because it's not Ariel. I don't think anyone could say that Ariel would be entitled to additional payment. They haven't paid anything more than what State Farm released. And so if State Farm is called upon to pay Ariel anything more, Ariel is getting a complete windfall. It gets a restored property plus another $1 million just to spend on whatever it chooses.
But that's not at least what the facts in the record allege. So we review the facts in their favor, right?
We are,
with the testimony that they owe, or they're now indebted to Universal. I mean, that windfall argument doesn't align with that view of the facts, right?
But it does, because that's the key. And that's one point I'd like to clarify from what counsel stated earlier. There is literally no agreement between Universal and Ariel, which is no written agreement whatsoever, which is quite remarkable when you're talking about a $3 million plus project.
Why does there have to be an agreement? Why isn't the evidence that is in the record of indebtedness just the assertion that we are indebted to Universal? Why isn't that enough? I mean, it seems like our case law indicates that that's enough.
Well, no.
Because then the jury gets to determine the credibility of those statements.
But that's where I disagree, because I think the case law that exists, it reflects situations where you have an agreement between a contractor and an insured, where if that amount isn't paid to the contractor, there could be a mechanics lien or other issues that result that ultimately cause the insured harm. Here, Universal has zero claim whatsoever against Ariel.
Are you saying that there has to be a claim now?
I'm saying that if you're going to discuss about something about indebtedness, you would have to have an actual basis for the indebtedness. I mean, here,
and what's your best authority that stands for that proposition? At summary judgment, that is the quantum of proof that is necessary to get over a Rule 56 motion.
Well, the quantum of proof is just simply the ability to say, if I'm going to claim a debt, you actually have to have some sort of written instrument or basis upon which to do that in the construction field.
So I'm not aware of any authority that stands for that proposition, which is why I'm asking you, what's your best case?
Sure. Well, I wish if I could cite you one here, that wasn't anything that we really briefed. I mean, the key to me is that what the policy requires is that they demonstrate that they actually spent the amount. We know they didn't. So then the next question, I guess, that we're turning to is there evidence of indebtedness? And if you look at what Mr. Mitchell and what Mr. Gelb testified to, both of them basically said, and this is where I think the district court's order kind of came down, is to say, if you read what they said, they can't really identify what anybody owes to anyone because there's nothing that backs it up. They don't have an actual contract that is for any set price to do the work. So, I mean, Mitchell, as Universal's representative, could have submitted an invoice in, I suppose, that says, I want $5 million, or a subcontractor
could
say that.
Isn't that kind of what I take your point, there's no written contract, there was no bid, there was no process, you know, that we can point to, but at least as I understand the argument, it's that the Mr. Coughlin's scope of work, which was a running document, it was changing over time, being adjusted based on what was actually being done, that is in effect the agreement.
Well, and again, that's just impossible based on the facts in the record, because what Mr. Coughlin testified to is that he was out at the property shortly after the fire loss and never returned. He had no idea what was being done out there. He never saw whether the work
was
completed.
But he was kind of the intermediary between the parties. They'd say, hey, we did this, or we have to do this, add it to the scope of work, and he maybe was sitting at his computer. But does the fact that he wasn't on the property, I don't know that... Why does that make a difference?
Well, because again, I think what's being suggested here today is he's the oracle for purposes of establishing what work needed to be done and how much it cost and that the work was actually performed. I mean, when he was deposed, he said, I have no idea if the work's even been done. I mean, he's as removed from this as anyone could possibly
counsel,
be.
So, counsel, what I struggle with that argument is you are focusing on one witness at a time, where, I mean, the reason we have trials is we have lawyers, let lawyers present their cases, and they can rely on multiple witnesses if they want. They can rely on Coughlin for part of it. Ariel can rely on their own people for other parts of it. They can turn to Mitchell for other parts of it. So if we put all of their evidence together, isn't there a genuine issue of material fact as to what amount was spent to repair this property and whether that amount has already been fully reimbursed by State Farm with that $3.4 million payment, or perhaps there's some amount more than that?
The reason I disagree with that is just simply if the transcript testimony is such that Mr. Gelb of Ariel and Mr. Mitchell of Universal both testified that there's nothing that was spent beyond what State Farm released.
That is not how I read the deposition testimony, counsel.
Oh, okay, because that is absolutely the fact. I mean, there is
so,
no
counsel,
no one
there are questions and answers, some of which have been cherry-picked out. But there's also longer discussions by Gelb and Mitchell saying the amount that's not paid is somewhere in the range of $1 to $2 million. And I'm generalizing. It's not, you know, each witness spoke differently on those topics, but it made it clear that there's some amount that they believe State Farm still owes under the terms of the policy.
But I think that's where I'm drawing a distinction with that, though, is that I understand they're saying that we'd like more money or we think there's amounts that are unpaid. What I'm saying, though, is that there's no evidence whatsoever that there was actually any money spent by Ariel to perform these repairs. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, I think now going to the policy language, I mean, I think that's what controls here. Mm-hmm. The issue then becomes, why would Ariel be entitled to amounts beyond what it actually spent to have a fully restored property? Because like I said, then you get into a windfall situation where either Ariel gets a complete windfall, mm-hmm. or you end up in a situation where Universal is getting a complete windfall because Universal did the work for $3.3 million and the property is fully restored. There's no subcontractor claiming that it's owed money by Universal. And so you're in a situation where Universal is coming forward and basically standing in the shoes now of Ariel and saying, well, we would like more money.
So if let's just like keep everything the same except that Ariel cut a check for the $1.5 million, whatever. Before they brought the suit. The facts otherwise are the same, establishing the scope of work or whatever. Would that then you would have had to pay that out, or would that have changed materially, or is there some other basis why even if they had, so is it just come down to literally they didn't write the check?
Well, so that goes, so you're exactly on point in the sense that if they had proof of actual payment beyond what State Farm had released, then we'd move into that second question of, was that payment for necessary repairs? And that's where State Farm may say, well, our estimate was different. That's the kind of thing that I think maybe does end up in appraisal, you know, if you have a dispute about the amount of loss.
You know, that's really, go ahead.
No, just a quick clarifying question on the 3.3. So again, I'm going back to like the amounts that you did pay. Were those paid under a different provision, not the already paid part, but that was a separate appraisal? Because I had thought that they didn't actually pay those amounts before you cut them a check. So what was the difference there in which then that those payments were fine under the policy, even though they had not actually cut a check to Universal, but
sure,
this 1.5 is?
Yep, and so that just kind of goes to how and when payment is issued under the policy contract, the policy conditions. And so when we're talking about here, that amount that you actually spend that is necessary to repair, replace, lost, or damaged property, that's kind of a cap in terms of what State Farm is saying it will pay on a claim. We're only going to pay as much as you actually spent. And so in the situation you're talking about, when State Farm comes out and makes a payment, it does it based on its own adjustment and evaluation. It doesn't necessarily need to receive that invoice at the outset to make a payment on a claim. In fact, when you're talking about the differences between actual cash value and replacement cost value, State Farm can issue a check and you may never do the repairs. You can collect your actual cash value payment and put it in your pocket and never do the repairs. So it kind of comes down to how and when the payments are being characterized. But ultimately, what I think kind of makes this case is that we're talking about amounts that you actually spent that was necessary. There's no proof that Ariel spent a dollar out of pocket. I think anything Ariel will be awarded is a complete windfall. Universal has no right to claim money under the policy contract whatsoever. And Universal to say, well, we have some indebtedness against us is completely belied by the fact that they don't have a written contract. They don't have agreement for a set price.
So I'm concerned about your answer to Judge Bentley's question, because it seems to me that you are now substituting the words in your contract that you drafted, actually spent, to actually paid. That the only way that an insured can satisfy this provision of the contract is if they have actually paid the invoice or paid the estimated cost of repair. Is that right? Is that your claim?
Well, I want to make sure, I don't want to fight the question, but what I am saying is that, again, I think the policy provision is sort of a cap on dollars spent. So I think the reason that policy
provision... I don't understand that answer.
Okay. Well, I think the reason the policy provision exists is so you don't have a situation where there's windfalls. So you don't have a situation where an insured has a deal with a contractor where the contractor comes out and does the repair work for $10,000, but the insurance company is paying $15,000.
But isn't that the necessary part that we're not talking about here, that whether or not the payments were necessary?
Well, so right. I mean, when I'm answering that question, I'm assuming that the scope is the same. I mean, that everyone sort of agrees on what the scope is. But so it doesn't end up in a situation where you have a restored property and then you have a bunch of extra money beyond that.
Yeah, my real concern is that we're not dealing with $10,000. We're dealing with $1.5 million that perhaps the insured is not able to pay without coverage from its insurance company. And so it goes ahead and makes the repairs, becomes indebted to the amount, and then seeks reimbursement from the insurance company, which seems like a reasonable thing to do. But I think what I'm hearing from you is that because those amounts were not actually paid by the insured, they have not satisfied the terms of the contract.
I don't exactly agree, because I think in a situation like that, if you have a difference of opinion about what the scope is, if you're talking about we have a difference of opinion of $1.5 million, typically that's going to be present before the work is done. Most contractors aren't going to be doing a work for $1.5 million with no written agreement or understanding how they're going to get paid. But that's what makes this unique, and that's why I think this is fatal to the case under the policy terms.
Thank you, Counsel. Your time's expired.
Thank you, Your Honors. The deposition testimony submitted on summary judgment before the court is that there was a longstanding relationship between Universal and Ariel, and when riots and the fire happened, there's a phone call made to Universal to get moving and help mitigate a horrific situation. So the evidence is that there is an agreement, and it's an oral one, and that's perfectly enforceable for commercial property in Minnesota. With respect to the argument that at the end of the day, there's absolutely going to be a windfall, I ask the court to bear in mind that Mitchell refers Conklin to Ariel public adjuster utilizing that software utilized by State Farm. It would be remarkable for the trier of fact to find a windfall when that same software is showing that the value of the work is X when it's software being used by the insurance industry. I don't think that that's a windfall, but in any event, that is for the trier of fact. Again, Universal is not just a paper contractor. They did some of the work. That explains why not everything is invoiced by a subcontractor. I think the trier of fact would understand, and this is the last point, factual point I'd like to leave the court with. I believe it's Exhibit C to Conklin's declaration, but in any event, it's that last letter from Brian Knapp, right on the eve of the statute of limitations expiring. First of all, he says they're not going to extend the period of limitations despite this enormous claim. It takes time to do a claim like this. This is not, this is a big piece of property, and it is taking a lot of time to do the work. And what he says is, I want to take a look at the ESX file, the electronic version of what was submitted. Why? A reasonable trier of fact is going to understand it's to evaluate it and assess it. And even in deposition testimony, he said that after 2 years, if he thought it was valid, may have paid it. So I ask the court for all these reasons to find that there is a genuine issue of material fact. Let the jury do its business in terms of whether or not this amount actually spent was actually honored. In terms of what that number needs to be, I respectfully request the precise number would be an appraisal, but if not, then the remedy is for the jury to decide. And I thank the court for its time. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for both parties. The matter is submitted, and we will issue an opinion in the time prescribed by statute. The court will take a brief recess and reset for the next case.
All rise.